Hello, and welcome to this week's Nature Now program. I'm Nan Evans, your host, and my guest today is Dr. Chris Kelly, oceanographer of the deep sea. This is actually part two of a three-part series. In part one, which aired here on KPTZ on April the 22nd, 2026, we talked about how the intense and extraordinary characteristics of the habitats of the deep sea influenced life there. We primarily discussed the lack of sunlight and therefore the absence of plant life, the reliance of senses other than sight to find food and mates, and the structure of food webs. Today, we will talk about adaptations to the massive water pressure on the structures of animals who live in the deep sea. We'll also talk about the strange behavior of gases at such depth, the variety of different habitats in the deep sea, and the complexity of the ecological systems across the vast oceans. But first, let me sort of spend a moment or two and remind you about Dr. Chris Kelly. He's had a long career. He's worked on deep water fisheries, biological communities living in the deep sea on rocky outcroppings and manganese crusts. He's done a lot of seamount biology and geology. And as a sideline, he has an interest in historic deep water shipwrecks. He's had innumerable hundreds of submersible dives, mostly in the Pacific Ocean, and the remotely operated vehicles, those are ROVs, that are not personed but are operated remotely from shipboard. So before we go on with a conversation with Chris Kelly, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, a little hint. That sound is called the bloop. Believe me, scientists called it the bloop. Scientists first heard this sound in 1997 while in the equatorial Pacific, listening for sounds of underwater volcanic activity. Further research picked up the same sound across thousands of miles in the Pacific Ocean. The origins of the sound remained a mystery for many years. Speculations abounded. Secret military operations, ship engines or other human-made sources, giant squid, whales. Well, what's your guess? Listen to the end of this program for the reveal. So now, talking more about the deep sea. We know it's a mysterious place, mostly unexplored. According to NOAA scientists, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, over 80% of the oceans remain unexplored. And it's important when we think about the fact that over 70% of the Earth's surface is water, ocean water, and 97% of the water on the Earth is contained in the oceans. Every now and again, we'll see news items that include a picture of some bizarre creature captured on film. And they just grab our attention. I remember something they called the Darth Vader isopod. Now, an isopod is sometimes known on for us terrestrial people as potato bugs or roly-polies. But this Darth Vader isopod was football-sized, nearly a foot in length. There are strange fish with jelly-like bodies that withstand incredible pressures. There are all kinds of worms, pygmy seahorses, strange fish. It's curious, though, that in many ways, the photo image we may see from the deep sea can be rather misleading because it allows us to form really superficial and incorrect impressions. However, we all have to grant it is a weird place. So here's the first question I want to ask Chris Kelly, and that is, what's the weirdest thing you've ever seen? Or maybe you have several weird things. And I know people must ask you that question because you spent a lot of time in the deep sea. And I know there are a lot of weird things down there. But what kinds of things have really make an impression as weird? And what's the story around your seeing them?
Okay, well, there's some things that are just weird-looking animals. And then there are other things that are just weird things that the animals do. So two classes of weird here.
Okay.
So one of the weirdest animals doing a really weird thing is a gulper eel that was actually videotaped on the research vessel Nautilus. You can actually go and look at the video there by Googling gulper eel Nautilus. And this was back in 2018, as I recall, on a trip up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And basically, this was a fish that looked like it was a blob with a little tail sticking out the end of it like that. And as the ROV got close to it, the blob completely transformed into an eel. And we call it the transformer fish because it didn't look anything like it.
So what it didn't even look like a fish.
It didn't even look like a fish. People had to scratch their heads to figure out what the heck we were looking at, this sort of floating black ball with a tiny little thing sticking out the back end, until they actually noticed that the thing sticking out the back end was a tail. And then to see a fish do that, like, why did this thing blow itself up with all this water and was drifting over the bottom? Nobody knows. No one had ever seen a gulper eel in its natural environment before. Now, a second thing I can think of, and this is a story I have told before, is one of my first deep water dives, not really, really deep, but 1,500 meters down, landed on the seamount, and across the landscape were all of these giant yellow lollipops. And these are actually sponges that were stock sponges. And on the top of each stock was sort of the ball, the actual sponge body. And it looked like a ball. Then it had a stalk. And these things are about 3 feet high.
3 feet.
Three feet high. That's good
giant.
Size.
Yeah.
And when you're looking across, you see them.
So it's like,
you know,
a little field of
not
giant.
Like a huge number, not like a field of wheat or something.
Yeah,
they were spread out. The first thought that came to my mind was, what planet am I on? So that was pretty weird, and that was an interesting experience. And then one other incident that I've seen is there were some brittle stars.
Occasionally you can see brittle stars in the intertidal, the low intertidal. They're really spindly arms around a little disc.
Yeah, a little disc, and they're on the bottom. Yeah. This brittle star, as a fish swam over it, he reached up and speared that fish and caught it, and he was going to eat it. And he probably did if we'd stayed and watched them too long. But I have never, ever seen a brittle star predate and catch a fish.
That is interesting. I'm visualizing this, the arm kind of going up and going, gotcha. You
know? Yeah, it's like, what?
Because I think a brittle star is being like many echinoderms. They're just what they can get off the surface or whatever they're on.
They're scavengers.
Yeah.
They're, you know.
Oh, or, you know, occasionally starfish.
Right.
Or sea stars prey on clams and the like.
But those are some of the really strange things. There's other things too. There's so many strange things going on down there.
Which is probably one of the reasons it's so fascinating.
Yes.
Let's go on to the next big physical thing, and that's pressure. Folks who scuba dive know the basic rule of you get one atmosphere increase with every 10 meters, round numbers. Okay, we're talking about the deep sea. So, 1,000 times what you have at the surface or something like that?
Yeah, depending on how deep you are.
Well,
course,
yeah.
It's gonna keep
but
going
that's
down.
Like seriously deep, and that's right. A lot of pressure. How does the structure of the creatures accommodate to that?
Pressure is primarily going to be a real problem for animals that have air cavities.
Right.
Right, and we do.
Mm-hmm.
And other mammals do, diving mammals
do. Yeah, a number
do.
Of fish do.
And, a number of fish do. So when you get down into the deep sea, a lot of fish avoid that problem by either not having an air bladder to control their buoyancy, and that's a gas-filled sort of structure that they use to maintain a certain depth. But the other part of it, too, is they can have very fatty livers instead that will aid with their buoyancy. Oh. But they're going to avoid air cavities because that's going to be a real problem. The other part of it, too, is a lot of deep-sea animals have very gelatinous type of bodies. And the way I kind of think about it is that water is incompressible, right, unlike air. And it seems to me that a lot of the strategy is trying to get your body to be as close to water as you possibly can. I'll give you an example. Some of the sea cucumbers that we've collected down there, they look okay when we actually collect them and put them in the collecting box. We bring them up and they're nothing but goo. because there's nothing. They're all sort of water with this very filmy.
Yeah.
They're just so flimsy, if you will. And this is the way that they can deal with pressure down there, where pressure is not going to affect an animal like that.
Sounds like as an adaptive technique, that's spread across the different kinds of animal groups.
Right. And of course, there's some physiological adaptations as well, such as pressure-sensitive enzymes that are active in deep water and especially designed to be active in under high-pressure environment. But just so your basic body, so that you don't implode or something like that, you avoid air pockets.
And so they're pressure-activated.
Tolerant. In other words, they work. And then if you bring them up and release that pressure, they actually denature. You know how a typical enzyme has got a very elaborate folded structure. Mm-hmm. And then if you release all the pressure on that, then the thing can completely unravel, if you will, and become non-functional. We don't know that much about that part of the deep sea, but yeah, it's very difficult to bring up live animals and active physiology.
So another aspect that's related to those high pressures, it does weird things to gases.
Yes.
And the behavior of gases.
Yes.
Explain some of that to me.
Well, let's just take a look at your basic environmental factors. So temperature, when you start at the surface, it's at here, it's, I'm trying to think, 50 degrees Fahrenheit or something. And then as you get deeper and deeper and deeper, it goes down and down and down. And then it kind of levels off very close to freezing. So it just keeps going down and then gets almost frozen. Okay, then you look at pressure, and pressure just keeps getting higher and higher and higher as you go deeper and deeper and deeper. Light starts going down, down, down until it extinguishes. And that's the pattern.
Yeah.
But oxygen bucks that pattern. Oxygen doesn't do that. Oxygen starts going down. Everything's great.
This is the concentration of oxygen.
The concentration of oxygen in dissolved oxygen in water.
Yeah.
And it starts to go down. And then at some point, depending on where you are, In the Pacific, you know, for example, because I know the Pacific more than any other thing, then it stops going down, and then it starts going back up again. And in Hawaii, where I lived and worked for many, many years, we used to call that peak low, if you will, the oxygen minimum, because that's where it got the lowest. Although it's here on the West Coast, where you have a continental shelf, you can get true oxygen minimum where it's anoxic. It's below 1 milligram per milliliter of oxygen there. In the islands, it doesn't get quite that low, but still you get that point where it's as low, very, very low, that a lot of animals can't tolerate that. Other animals love it. But anyway, it gets low, and then it starts going back up. And that oxygen can actually create some interesting stratifications of communities down there. And why does it do that? Well, I've heard a couple of things. Like one of them is because there's a lot of organic matter that's being metabolized. The particulate organic matter is descending as well, and they're using up a lot of the oxygen to do this. So when you get deep water, you get this minimum zone. Another theory in the Pacific was that we're getting really cold water from Greenland that's actually coming down through the Atlantic, around South America, and up into the Pacific. And that's why we have this cold oxygenated water. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what it is.
It seems very weird.
It's very weird, but it is very measurable. You can watch this curve go down and down and down, and then, oops, there's the bottom, and up, up, up.
So does that then translate to, once you've passed, when it starts going back up again, that you get additional creatures who need a little bit of oxygen or a little more oxygen to make their physiologies work?
Yes. So you get surface oxygen levels would be somewhere around 6 to 7 milligrams per milliliter. And that doesn't mean anything. It's just say 6 to 7. You get down to the oxygen minimum, now you're talking about 0.5 or 1. And a lot of the corals down there, at least in tropical waters, they seem to be, deep water corals are around 3, somewhere around that. You don't have that many deep water corals in that really minimum, really low oxygen levels, but you can get them above and you can get them below. But then at some point, the deepwater corals don't want too much oxygen. Of course, you're getting a light and temperature and other, and so they're not going to go all the way to the surface. They want a specific oxygen level, you know, and then you can get sometimes the same type of animal that's above and below the oxygen minimum because the actual levels are the same because it's coming back up. It doesn't come all the way back up like the surface, but it comes back up. It comes like 1 or 0.5. It comes back up to 3 or higher.
It's really hard to imagine, and it's really hard to imagine sort of what that means physiologically.
Yes.
So let's move on to thinking about ecosystems. We still have to sort of carry with us the physical characteristics of that environment that we talked about instead of the adaptations. So more pieces of the puzzle. We sort of know intuitively that there are a lot of different habitat types on the ocean floor, from desert-like plains to rocky mountains and deep valleys. How do you think about the variety and those different habitats?
One thing is that the communities down there tend to be stratified by depth. So you get from all of the dives we've done all around the Pacific, you'll get sort of a certain type of animal that's always between 1,000 and 2,000 meters. And then you get down to 4,000 to 5,000, you'll get another type of animal. You know, it may not be the exact same species, but it's related. Pressure and various other types of things going on. The second thing is that the animals are not distributed uniformly, at least on seamounts, because I've been mostly working on seamounts. And what I mean by that is you can go to a seamount or you can go to a part of a seamount and you will hardly see anything on it. It's just rock and it's just kind of barren. And you're trying to scratch your head, like, why is that? You know, we're not even seeing, you know, sea lilies or, you know, brittle stars or anything like that. And then you'll go to another part of that seamount or a different seamount, and you can't set the vehicle down. The number of animals, particularly corals and sponges and other things, is so dense that you can't even stop and land on the bottom without crushing a lot of animals. So you have to just hover in there, and they're just amazingly dense communities. And we're trying to figure out why. What are the conditions?
Yeah, what are the things other than surface type and if they're comparable depths and such? But what else?
Yeah, well, one thing is that it's important to realize that a lot of the deep sea communities are dominated by filter feeding, because remember, their food source is right. So we're talking about sponges and corals primarily, and those are the dominant things, even though there's a lot of animals that live on sponges and corals and around them on these seamounts, crabs and sea stars and everything else. And those filter feeding animals, there's a very large number of those. They are going to be dependent on current, right? Because their filtering efficiency is going to go up with higher currents as long as they can hold on to the substrate and keep planted on there. So we tend to find a denser community in higher current environments and a less dense community in lower current environments down there. And it's just the way, you know, currents aren't the same down there as they are on the surface. A lot of times the deep currents are more tidal currents, you know, because you don't get any of the surface type of activity, wind-driven currents or anything else. You can also get these internal waves, I guess, where you get these big pulses going through. But because of that, we've found a lot of these really dense communities actually on ridges coming off of seamounts. And the reason being is the ridges can serve as a barrier to current flow if they're oriented perpendicular to the prevailing current flow. The current hits it, then it starts going up over the top of it if it's a long ridge, and then it gets accelerated over the top. And when it gets accelerated right at that top area, that's where you can find some really amazing communities. So current is a big deal.
In addition to density, I'm thinking, you know, terrestrial or shallow water systems. If you look at a food web, it just goes all over the place, and it's really complex. Do you see a similar kind of thing in some of the communities in the deep sea?
Again, if you consider the filter feeders as sort of a base, for everything. And then you get a lot of animals that are dependent upon the filter feeders. So you have a lot of these little crustaceans called squat lobsters and crabs that live on or in sponges or corals, and they can feed on maybe mucus that the corals are releasing and so forth. And brittle stars too will intertwine among the corals, and we found in the sponges as well. So there's a lot of dependency on these base groups like corals and sponges down in the deep sea on seamounts, not necessarily on sediment areas, but on seamounts. And then the other part of it, I guess, is that the seamount, it's almost like an island. You know, it's not connected to other types of seamounts.
So you see island ecology stuff going on the seamounts?
Well, you know, this is why in early days of deep sea research, they claimed that seamounts were actually sites of high endemism, where you're getting speciation on these because they're so isolated. Now we understand that it's just because we hadn't visited enough seamounts, so everything was kind of new. Now we've gotten to the point where we can see a lot of similar animals on seamounts throughout the Pacific, and they're not necessarily sites of endemism. But what we think we're seeing is at some point on that seamount, animals have to arrive. I mean, they're usually volcanic. They arose sometime in the past. Animals found them, and they settled on them. Okay, and in some cases, the community kind of reflects who made it there or who made it there first and got established, you know, or something happened and a bunch of them all died off and something took over. But you're seeing that type of thing. So you can see within a particular depth zone, very similar things. Say you have a group of 10 animals at this seamount where the summit is right at, say, 1,000 meters. You know, you have a whole bunch of animals, but the most dominant ones, there's 10 real dominant ones. But from seamount to seamount at that depth, they're really number one. The most abundant ones can change and switch, but they're all kind of there. It's that, like, there's more of one on one seamount than another one. And you get slight differences as well as who are the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that type of thing that's going on. And you do occasionally see new species on these things. But it's more, I don't know if you call it island. You're not necessarily getting genetic barriers like you would.
Like you do in some of the terrestrial systems.
Yeah, because a lot of these animals are designed to actually release their larvae to travel quite a...
Well, that's what my brain was going, is a lot of that because there's sort of dispersal of the larvae in the currents.
Right, and the larvae can live for a long time, and they can disperse. But on the other hand, too, there are particularly corals that can actually hold on and produce competent larvae. They're not releasing eggs and sperm in the water, and they're not getting fertilized in the water and then traveling quite a distance. The coral holds on to everything and releases the larvae right next to itself. And the larvae then settles immediately within a meter or so. And we think that perhaps that's involved in creating these humongously dense communities or numbers of certain species in these really high-density communities. We don't know much about reproduction in deep sea corals, but we suspect it's because they're releasing these planula all around them and that they can grow a community very quickly.
Now let's talk a bit about the kinds of communities that they're discovering at the hydrothermal vents, the hot spots where things are coming up from the mantle of the earth. Weird things happen there too.
Very weird things. I'm not much of a vent guy myself. I kind of like my seamounts to be long dead, cold. But I've seen a lot. We've dove on hydrothermal vents before. And basically, there's a lot of minerals and a lot of gases like hydrogen sulfide and carbon dioxide and methane and other things that could come out of the, not necessarily methane, excuse me, but that are coming out of these vents. And as it turns out, a lot of the vent animals around there are not oxygen-based animals. They're using hydrogen sulfur or something else for their metabolism. They have a chemical
metabolism. Very different chemistry.
Chemistry. And so they're completely dependent on being around an active vent. So
it's very alien.
It's very alien. And when that vent ceases, which they all do over time, then the whole community disappears and it's gone. And then another vent appears, and then the community will suddenly appear around that other vent. you know, and then that'll disappear over time.
Okay, let's go to the other extreme. What about communities on the sort of flat abyssal plains?
Yeah.
I know, I'm forcing you away from your beloved seamounts.
That's right. So a lot of these are scavenger type of communities with fish. You have a lot of brittle stars and things like that that are, and also sea cucumbers can be down there. They're picking up detritus. So they tend to be more scavenging in that particular area because you're not going to get the accelerated current flow. You're certainly going to have sort of some type of current mm-hmm. flow over these. It's very stable. It's very uniform. I mean, you can have these sediment flats, the abyssal seafloor, that can go for thousands of miles that are just uniform, pretty much, with some subtle differences, of course, with currents and some other things. But you have certain types of animals that are adapted to living in that type of environment. So, for example, some of the fish down there and the macrurids, the rat tails, there's groups of those that live on that type of environment, and they're scavenging, you know, carcasses down there, so forth. I don't know that much about them because I personally have never dove on one of those.
You know, I'm now picturing a complex world that is probably just as complex and variable as the systems we're used to in the terrestrial world.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
And it's just so different than what we're used to that we have to get our heads around it and try to understand what's really going on when it's really hard to get down there and study mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, that's coming really clear how hard it is and all the limitations. There are so many things to talk with you, Chris, about the deep sea. And to listeners, come back again. There is a part three. To end today's program, let's listen again to that mystery sound. That was the bloop. It was first recorded in 1997, after 20 years of that first recording and countless deployment of hydrophones across the vast Pacific Ocean. Scientists at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory in 2025 finally pinpointed the origin of this weird sound. It's an ice quake, an iceberg cracking and breaking away from an Antarctic glacier. With the advance of global warming, the bloop has become an often heard sound of the oceans. Do you know, by the way, that sound can travel thousands of miles in the ocean? Man-made low-frequency sounds and certain whale sounds can travel halfway across the globe. That's over 19,000 kilometers or nearly 12,000 miles. Well, thanks so much for listening to another episode of Nature Now, and please come back to listen to part three, the last in this fascinating conversation with Chris Kelly about the mysteries of the deep ocean. If you missed a broadcast version of Nature Now, or if you want to go hear a program again, you can find it on the KPTZ website, or you can listen to Nature Now on the podcast app on your smartphone or computer. Just search for Nature Now. We also have an Instagram site where you can see photographs and links to some of the materials that were included or referenced in this program. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich.